Okay. Well, I guess I can take a minute to explain my name, or rather how to pronounce it. It's basically Chamundeswari. It's from the southern part of India. And it's actually a Hindu name. It's the consort of Lord Shiva, but in a different form. So there's a story behind it, etc. So you can quiz me on that later. Anyway, well, I'm here to talk a little bit about the legal aspects and perhaps international diplomacy related to traditional knowledge and traditional medicine. I consider as being part of that. My background is in law, and my main area of research is international law, public international law, and interactions between public international law and intellectual property rights. A couple of times, I think patents have come up, and the whole area of intellectual property protection, if you like, in the context of medicine. Now, public international law is, if you like, an area which covers human rights, health, etc. So you get an idea of what sorts of issues are involved in public international law. So it's got a very broad remit. And intellectual property rights is, in many ways, much more restricted. So treaties within intellectual property rights. A very popular one is the Trade-Related Intellectual Property Rights Agreement, TRIPS. Patents is covered under that. Is based within a philosophy which is a bit more restricted than, if you like, the public international law's objectives and goals. I'm going to touch on the rationale of intellectual property rights, and then move on to the impact that the discussions on traditional medicine and health have had on intellectual property rights. So in some ways, how some of the issues that are being framed at the international level have fundamentally questioned the basis of intellectual property rights protection, and in particular, patents. But of course, you know, it touches on other areas of intellectual property rights, which is copyright. You write a book, so you've got rights in what you've written, and that's copyright. Whereas patent, you get a new pill out, for example, or a new method or a new technique, and that's patent. And so there are various different varieties of intellectual property rights. And then I'll talk to you about international diplomacy in this area. The key international organization that is pulling a lot of these issues together is the World Intellectual Property Organizations, organization called WIPO. And I'm going to talk about two key diplomacy points which I think could benefit the IPR debate, as well as protection, whatever form and shape that might require to take in the context of traditional knowledge and medicine. And then finally, I'd talk to you a little bit about the procedural and the forum aspects as to where these two diplomacy initiatives could take place. So I guess there are various reasons why traditional knowledge and traditional medicine are worthy of protection, I suppose promotion and preservation. And I think some of the things that come to mind are effectiveness, perhaps less expensive than other types. It's closer to communities, it's closer to people, and in a number of different ways, I think, despite the fact that it'll have, you know, as many have been speaking about, pressures on the cultivation, etc., I think if it's good, then it should really benefit global health goals. And the Millennium Development Goals, as you know, we heard in the morning, are really difficult to achieve, so we need to try and, you know, make use of as many different systems of medicine and thought that we have to achieve those goals, as I think that's really crucial. And at the same time, I can think of a few reasons as to why traditional knowledge in medicine perhaps are not suitable in the modern world. I mean, society is fast, and anyway, these key resources are depleting, and the scientific method now, I suppose, is much more narrowly defined. So there is an overwhelming trend of modernity, if you like, that probably is, you know, looking towards throwing out the old, getting in the new. After all, you know, that is the whole process of life. You destroy old systems, you get new systems in. being controversial, but I think as a lawyer, you're looking at both sides of, you know, the issue. But anyway, I think traditional medicine, traditional knowledge are really having to fight for their corner. And, you know, why not? I think they should do so. And in doing so, I think the key benefit is that it's having an impact. We're going back to some of the fundamental aspects of the way in which we have governance, we have law. And one of those aspects, one of those areas, of course, is intellectual property rights. So I'm only going to touch on that. Now, the rationale of intellectual property rights. Okay, it grew up, most of the law relating to intellectual property rights, patent protection, copyright, design, trademark, etc., developed and proliferated during the Industrial Revolution. So you're thinking about, you know, mid-19th century onwards. At the same time, artistic creations, literary works were also being protected under the Berne Convention, etc. So there's been a proliferation of these instruments in the last 150 years or so. And the trend is really towards strengthening the rights that are, you know, granted under these different IP rights, which are basically individual exclusive property rights, which creators, inventors, or producers could apply for and get. And then, so there's a huge element of exclusion involved in that, which I think, you know, straight away does not probably fit into the way in which TK and TM are probably produced, used, and, you know, a part of society. So on the one hand, innovation is looked at as being important in an economy, and that is promoted by granting of exclusive rights. And exclusive could really mean anywhere from an individual to a group of individuals, and certainly it does affect a number of different stakeholders. So that's the trend towards intellectual property rights at the international level. Now, the internationalization of intellectual property rights is the more recent trend in the last 10 to 15 years. So before that, predominantly, you'd find countries protecting or granting rights in their own respect. So national laws are responsible for this, for enforcement as well as for, you know, granting of rights. But now the internationalization of IP has meant that international treaties are trying to harmonize, trying to uniform, trying to make uniform the rights that can be granted to, you know, holders, producers of knowledge. And of course, that means that you're looking at, you know, the predominant trends being more commercial, in the sense that you've got there's a new initiative for a patent treaty, and for grant of a patent, you'll have to identify. You'll have to prove that it's novel. You'll have to prove that it is actually useful. And you'll also have to prove that it's not part of what already exists prior art. It's not out there in the open as well. So if you don't fit these criteria, then you're not going to be, you know, you're going to be basically outside the remit of protection that is being offered. Now, if you don't have that protection, then the value that your knowledge has is much lesser as well, because the way in which you'd probably share it, etc., would become much more diffuse. And that is basically the logic of the internationalization of IP. And essentially, this trend continues, is seen through all of the bilateral, multilateral, regional, global negotiations, you know, throughout the patent system as well as the copyright system as well. So now this is basically where all the treaties are going. And the rationale, again, is in terms of the, you know, you produce, there's an incentive to innovate as well. But another part of intellectual property rights, the key rationale is that it's also a moral right. So you produce something, and therefore it has to belong to you. You have to be given the rights to control that sort of knowledge. So one of the ways in which a place, or if you like, you know, traditional medicine can find its corner out is by looking at the whole aspects of moral rights. What kind of, you know, moral frameworks are applied to determine what types of rights? Of course, the most popular one on which most international treaties are based on is if you like, the Lockean theory, which is basically it's your own labor. So you, therefore, you've got to be rewarded for it, and therefore you have to have property rights equivalent to it. But once you come to knowledge that is produced more collectively, you start asking and questioning, what exactly do you mean by own labor? Whose own labor is it? Is it individual? Is it more collective? And this is where I think the system we have in place now falls really short, because how do you actually segregate, if you like, my labor from what I've actually learned from before? So you get into very, very tricky questions here. And currently, the World Intellectual Property Organization has committees looking at folklore and traditional medicine. So you've got the International Committee on Folklore and Traditional Medicine, where even the definition of traditional medicine, traditional knowledge, is in legal terms quite diffuse. It'd be very difficult to actually pinpoint what is and isn't traditional medicine, traditional knowledge. That's because it's so much integral to everything around it. And in some ways, it's actually good, but in some ways, it's actually not too good. If you want to then, you know, inquire about how to, you know, what is it that we're protecting? But that is a debate that I think we should essentially have. Now, the stakeholders in this debate are slowly being extended to beyond governments, to beyond, you know, non-governmental organizations, and going out into the people who actually work on the ground. Not sure very much about that, but I'm only going to talk about two of the key diplomacy initiatives that I think could actually benefit in this context. The first one, I think, would be the recognition of the notion of collective, or recognition of collective production of knowledge. And how can that be rewarded? How can that be preserved? And secondly, the diversification of the notion of incentive. So currently, you've got the incentive is that you produce something, or you've got knowledge that is worth sharing. What you get in return would be your rights to commercialize, your rights to sell, buy, etc. So it's a very, very property law-based, economic law-based transaction. The incentive is very much based in that sense. So, for example, the incentive in terms of, yeah, you're respected for the knowledge you have, is not something that's embedded within other systems surrounding the IPR system. So that's not an incentive enough. So one of the ways in which we could expand individual autonomy-based idea of rights would be to look at how we, I suppose, agitate this whole notion of what is meant by incentive, and how exactly we diversify the notion of incentive. So these are the two sort of diplomacy initiatives that I think would be good to, you know, be put on the table. It is at the moment on the table in different ways, but still the dominant agenda is about including a little bit of elements of the collective, as opposed to, you know, looking fundamentally at the whole idea of granting exclusive rights. And I think eventually it will get there. But now, the how can this be done? I mean, what's where can this be done? What forum? Now, there is an agenda at the World Intellectual Property Organization called the Development Agenda. And the Development Agenda has been brought in by countries in South America, including a couple of Islamic countries, including Iran. And the main aim of that is to revisit some of the key international treaties. As a small step, the key amendment that's being proposed is to take into account the interests of developing countries and of traditional communities. Now, this is might sound very simple, the key amendment, but then it'll open doors to various stakeholders, various ideas, various methodologies to come into, you know, come onto the table at par. So I think key, that's one of the intervention areas that can actually be done. So the development agenda at WIPO. And, you know, as I heard the talk in the morning, seeing that the gross national happiness is basically a development strategy, I wonder if that can be applied. I mean, I thought probably I'd look at that as the next you know, research paper to see how that really works with the idea of development within WIPO. And this is as far as you know, traditional medicine. This is as far as the initiatives at WIPOGO, so development agenda, the key one. And the second one, obviously, is the work of the Committee on Traditional Knowledge and Folklore. And currently, the stage at which we are in that committee is to include the voices of as many communities as possible, and to then provide a draft treaty on, you know, different elements of what it, how can we define traditional knowledge, what are the different elements, how does it sit in with current legal instruments, either international or national. So very early stages, but still, again, another committee to watch out for in terms of how traditional medicine is being embedded into the international legal system. So I suppose to sum up, intellectual property rights is very much part of what we call international economic law. And of course, you know, the bottom line for that is a strong, you know, strong economic growth. And what I've talked about really now is to look at the ethics of intellectual property rights and to look at the whole idea of property rights very good for a certain type of growth. But if we are talking about global health, if we are talking about respect for communities, if you're talking about inclusion, now all of these are, you know, you'd find them in General Assembly declarations, you know, one after the other, thousands of declarations that go on every year. So how do you actually square the circle and bringing both these things together? Maybe you have to throw one out and keep the other, or, you know, and we don't know which one is going to be thrown out, which one's being kept, but I think it's too late to actually do that, because there is enough support for both. The key thing is how are we going to actually get the compromise? And it really is left to strong diplomacy, and there is scope within the law, and that's the key point, because people look at law as actually supporting certain interests as opposed to other, but it's just a matter of putting the ideas out there, really. And I think there is quite good scope, particularly within the debates that is happening right now, but it's the way we intervene in it that will probably make the difference. Thanks.
Thank you for the nice presentation. In some of these talks about intellectual property rights, for me there's a contradiction with regard to traditional medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the beginning you said only a new thing can be patented.
Mm-hmm.
So how can a traditional medicine, where we have written the knowledge in books, be patented?
Okay. When I talk about new, what I mean is something that's not been done before, essentially, or someone's not claimed a right for it before within the system. I think that's what we mean by new. Novel would be the word that we'd use for it, actually, as opposed to something that exists earlier.
So when the knowledge is written in the book.
Oh, when the knowledge is written in the book, then it would be prior art. So essentially you have databases and you have to trawl through these databases to make sure that, whatever you are submitting, the application you're submitting with the written either methods or techniques or invention, if it exists prior in another book, in a text, then that means it's prior art. It will not be considered novel, actually. And it will be revoked, yes. So
we are safe.
it really depends on whether your prior art search database contains that sort of knowledge. And I think there is a big issue about languages that perhaps are not, you know, readable. And if it's more oral, then I think that's not really clearly accommodated in prior art searches as well. And I think one example, there's an institute in Bangalore called the TKDL. I think that's an online electronic resource which is trying to translate a lot of Sanskrit scripts. So it might help to some extent, but I think there are arguments against that as well, because it might lead to piracy, it might lead to people just looking at it and then, you know, taking it away without actually recognizing it in any different way. So there are, it's a sort of double-edged sword, I think, to commit things to writing or to have things translated.
Does that No,
other languages count as well, as long as it's written down and as long as you're able to find it. I think that's the key thing, you've got to find it.
Thank you so much.
I'm sorry. Oh, sorry.
Okay. Anyway, my question is that, let's say, you know, for the traditional systems of medicines,
yeah,
local knowledge, whatever you call it, let's say we have a problem now, you know, and, you know, nowadays, some of the problems, like, though it is your own, you know, original or local knowledge,
yeah,
now, but you have at least your own medical system or tradition,
yeah,
you know? But you don't know how to really protect,
yeah,
the interest of you, you know, your own medical system. You don't know about the IPR is law and stuff like that. And as for example, with the Tibetan medical system, there are many Tibetan herbs which are being, you know, exploited and commercialized, and also actually being a really unique and traditional Tibetan medicinal plant, but you know, in the name of other kind of countries or kind of companies that have been,
yeah,
you know, sold and they, you know, manufactured and commercialized. So my question is, how do we really, two questions, number one, how do we really prevent our medicine or our traditional knowledge, you know, from getting, you know, exploited like this to the IPR law or whatever? And second question, how do we really fight?
Okay, fighting, get me, okay? So, so I come at a discount at the moment, so that's fine. I start at the beginning. I apologize for being fast, but if you want to go a little bit more into detail of this, I can give you the name of the book that I've recently published, which covers some of these aspects. You can read it at your leisure then. And in terms of, you know, ignorance of the law is not an excuse. That's one of the key things. So if the law exists and someone else uses that law, then yes, they'd be granted their rights. And even if, I think, you know, if you were to go and use the law to protect your system of medicine, and even if it was able to protect it sort of, you know, more wholly, I think that it still would leave gaps. So using the current system is, yes, be aware of it. There are, you know, organizations that could help. So that's the one way to do it. But then fundamentally, I think there are flaws in the way in which this system actually works currently. So I think we should be addressing that as well, alongside the more short-term approach of actually using the system to protect however little or, you know, medium-term protection you can actually get. And certainly, you know, WIPO is very much out there to create awareness and to also aid people in protecting any system of knowledge for that matter. So I suppose short-term, use the system, be aware, approach organizations, and, you know, online sources are fantastic for that, I think. But long term, I don't think the system is very geared up to protect some of these more integral forms of ways of life, if you like. So that has to be addressed as well, and that's what's happening at the moment. So.
It also seems to me that to depend on the law to protect indigenous people is against, say, commercial companies or something like that. It's putting them at a terrible disadvantage because the commercial companies have access to such law firms and so on. And indigenous people just, you know, maybe they can find a lawyer, but they just, they've got everything going against them. It just seems to be, to me, to be the wrong way to go about it.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. I mean, you could use law to, I think, keep piling on rights, which is when you can see companies, commercial companies, using these. But you can also use the law to make sure that you create a space where, you know, everybody could enjoy. So in that sense, I'd suppose, You'd without resorting, it's more the sort of negative side, so keep out as opposed to sort of, you know, come in. But it's definitely there that the power gradient is really against indigenous groups, I think. That's just the truth of it.
Yeah. Well, apart from this IPR issue, there was always a discussion about like so-called intangible cultural heritage and UNESCO work.
Mm-hmm.
Do you, I mean, it has a link somehow, yeah?
It does.
It's prior art, it might be cultural heritage. So can you say something on that link?
Yeah, I mean, UNESCO, the preservation of cultural diversity and intangible heritage, it's a treaty that's called the Framework Treaty. So if you like, it doesn't give you the details, it doesn't give you the rules, as opposed to TRIPS, which is, you know, it gives you the law, it gives you the rules, it gives you the details, it goes into the nitty-gritties. So at the moment, it's only a recent treaty, it's about 4 or 5 years old, I think, and it's not actually as that much of universal reach as TRIPS is. There is scope within that to counter some of the effects, perhaps, of appropriation of some of the oral heritage. But I don't think it's been tested yet. Because TRIPS, the reason why TRIPS is just such a good treaty and why companies use it, good in the sense, good for whose rights, are sort of need to be asserted, is because you've got what's called the dispute settlement mechanism. So you can actually, there is a court type of thing, if you like, where you can actually go and say, you know, my rights are being, violated, or this is mine and, you know, it's been stolen, etc. Whereas the treaty you're talking about, the UNESCO treaty, is more about governments making a commitment to recognize this. And then it's individual governments who would then be responsible within their own national legal systems. So if you like, we don't have that sort of enforcement mechanisms that go with it. And yes, from the legal point of view, it's difficult because what would you actually enforce? You know, law is that sort of thing which compartmentalizes as well. So, you could talk about property rights, the whole thing about sacred sites. It is property law, essentially. You know, sacred sites and protection, fencing, etc. You're talking about rights of use. And the discourse is being had in different arenas. Bringing all these people together, bringing the methodologies together, is such a huge task. And that will have an impact on what you're talking about, you know, the effectiveness of the treaty you're talking about. Yes, there's a treaty in place. There are a number of treaties as well. And in fact, you don't even have to resort to treaties. You can resort to what's called international customary law, if you're able to even prove that. But that's, again, an uphill task. Expensive. Very much, depends on years of documentation, research, etc. And yeah, that has its own negative effects.
Can you mention your book?
Sorry?
Can you mention your book?
My book is it's called The International Legal Governance of the Human Genome. So that's a specific topic. And I deal with intellectual property rights in like half the book, and I suggest alternative governance forms as well in that. But if you, I suppose, Google my name, you should come up with the whole title.
To share a small example, maybe about 8 years ago, we were sending out erudite preparations from Nepal to Germany, and we were told by the person that we were sending our things through that the German government would no longer allow us to send our Kafa preparation because it had a mixture of Amalaki and Gota Kola in it, and there was a single Indian man who had patented the combination of Amalaki and Gota Kola and any single product that had that combination coming into Germany was not allowed. We had to pay him to do that. And so we contacted, I think her name is Vandana Shiva, a great mineral water activist. And he said, Vandana, can you help us out with this?
Yeah.
But it's very difficult, the complexities and what happens.
Moving
forward on this. I wonder if you can comment on that.
Well, I think this is actually quite a well-documented gap. It's called broad-use patents, in which case, and this happens actually quite a lot in the genetic resources that are collected. So it's about, you're supposed to actually talk about how exactly it is useful. So in this case, you're going to have to look at whether there is a case for revocation of that patent, because if it's broad enough, if it is really broad, and if it covers much more, then you know, it's meant to govern in the sense the invention actually is very, very broad, then it can actually be revoked, and that's how it should work really. And that's the way out on this one.
Thank you very much. Really interesting presentation. Pointer is here. Pointer belongs to? Does Sonam Dorje need pointer? Yeah, okay. Thank you. And is it on here? Yeah. Okay. I'll hook him up while we do that.
I use this or...
why don't you use it since you're speaking the English? Yeah.
No. 对, 还在前面。Okay.
Yeah, okay. All right, it's my great pleasure to introduce our next speaker, Sonam Dorje, who actually I was introduced to by Jan Salek in, I think, 2002, and Jan has worked with him extensively since. And we are very pleased that Sonam was able to be here with us. He is, I think he'll tell you a little bit about himself, a village doctor up in Agong village, and this is his first international conference, so we're very, very pleased to have him here to share his expertise. And Ma Jianzhong will be the translator, and you'll hear from him tomorrow?
Yeah, the day after tomorrow.
Tomorrow as yeah. Well. He's giving a paper.
I think, you know, Danik and Glover to provide Sonam Dorje this opportunity to, you know, to can participate this international conference. Actually, this is the first time for him to come to, you know, the international conference. And actually, he is a village doctor. Maybe he is one of the few people who can from the local village can participate. And I also would like to, you know, thank all of the effort the organizer made for him to can participate this conference.